TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Kevin Anderson, talk to the Oxford Climate Society. On January 25, 2019, Professor Kevin Anderson, the Chair of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, spoke at the Oxford Climate Society. He's one of the rare academics with a background in mechanical engineering, even worked on oil platforms as a young man. In addition to producing peer-reviewed research, he engages with European governments on issues ranging from shale gas, aviation, and shipping. He also brings a strong sense of justice and equity into his recommendations on how to prevent climate chaos. He said that it's 28 years since the IPCC's first report on climate change, and over a quarter of a century since the 1992 Rio Earth Summit. Now in 2019, and with the benefit of hindsight, we can trace our voyage of abject failure, he says, and with humility learn lessons for charting an alternative low-carbon course. Kevin Anderson also said, we need to explore how academia has abdicated its responsibility to hold government to account. Here's Kevin Anderson, starting off with his most compelling argument.
If just the top 10% global emitters reduce their carbon footprint to the level of the average European, so just the average EU citizen actually, and the other 90% make no reductions, no increases but no reductions, they just carry on as they're today, would there be any major reduction in global emissions? If so, what sort of size do you think you might see? Any ideas? Well, it's about a one-third cut in global emissions. And just bear in mind that the Paris pledges have no reduction by 2030. So that shows how keen we are on climate change. My provocation is that the shrinking budgets we have for 2 degrees centigrade, or indeed 1.5, together with highly unequal responsibility for carbon dioxide, and I'll be drawing that out during this presentation, embed equity at the heart of real mitigation. I couldn't have said that in 1990. 2000, perhaps by 2005, 2010, definitely equity becomes important. By 2019, it's absolutely at the heart of responding to climate change. I'll try and show why that is the case now. The issue of the asymmetric distribution of wealth, again, that's only because we've left it so late, underpins our ongoing failure to tackle climate change. This is my provocation. And that only when we acknowledge that will we move away from the incremental nonsense that we've done for the last 30 years to something that's much more akin with the system change that is now demanded for 2 degrees centigrade of warming. We're still dominating this in the news. There's only two things in the news are Brexit and Davos. This is the sort of view that I still hold of Davos, very much along these sort of lines. And we're doing just fine with the Davos thing. We mustn't disturb the dominant socioeconomic paradigm, ongoing growth, resources and power skewed to a privileged few who look after the rest of us, look down on us and make sure the world works well for us. In the climate discussions there, some of you will have seen this in the papers, covered by a lot of the papers, there were between 1,000 and 1,500 private jets flying the morally bereft to Davos to discuss issues around climate change. And it's about time we called these people out. But on climate, I would argue the Davos paradigm is legitimised in relation to climate change. I think it's fair to say pejoratively referred to as the climate glitterati, where that's Bloomberg, DiCaprio, Nick Stern, Christiana Figueres, Al Gore, or Mark Carney. But all these people have, you know, absolutely huge carbon footprints and then tell the rest of the world about what we need to do about climate change as they fly around in first class or business jet or their private business planes. But they're supported by a whole cadre of senior academics. So the academic community is desperately trying to ingratiate themselves with this group. They'll embed offsetting, negative emissions, geoengineering, carbon capture and storage, green growth, anything there that maintains evolution in relation to climate change within the system. The last thing we can do is propose something that may actually question the system. We mustn't do that. That's not to say those things in isolation might have some role to play, but collectively they're our dominant paradigm. So we've got Davos, but basically you can change it for COP. when I was there this year, and you go along to the side events and you'll just hear repeatedly wonderful stories about how every country's been doing, often supported by senior academics and NGOs. And then you think, well, hang on, the emissions went up by 2.7%. How can that be the case if every country's doing really well? Someone somewhere's lying. So this is a provocation. So let's put some bones on that provocation. So the international agenda, I mean, this is stuff you're all going to know, I suppose, so I can go through it quite quickly. Climate change, Paris commitment, hold well below 2, ideally aim for 1.5. And the reason we went, the argument was for 1.5, that many people are fully aware at 2 degrees C, lots of people will die. Probably quite a few people will die at 1.5. And let's also be clear that we know who they are, and we've known for a long time. There'll be low emitters, they'll be a long way from here, they'll typically be non-white. So we know who they are. And we've known that for the last 20 years, and we haven't cared. Let's be blunt about that. Paint the picture as it is. We haven't cared. But fortunately, in Paris, that community did start to put a bit of pressure on the world and came up with this idea of, should we aim for 1.5? And it certainly, with the 1.5 report, it does suggest that there are merits to that. Also, that we would take action in accordance with the best science, and very importantly, on the basis of equity. That was embedded in the agreement, embedded in every agreement we've had back to Kyoto Protocol. And yet, when you look at it, no country takes any notice of equity, including the UK, including the Committee on Climate Change, the new Swedish climate change law. Equity is just dismissed out of hand. A bit of lip service, but that's about it. And I'll come back to that later. I'm not going to go into the 1.5 report, but just a couple of quick reflections from it. Initially, I was really quite negative about us having a 1.5 degrees report because I don't think it's achievable. Nevertheless, I think I've changed my mind a little bit since it came out. I'm going to just draw two headline conclusions from it. There's obviously a lot of wonderful work in there. And the first one I think is really important is to recognise that it does appear that from an impacts point of view, the impacts are much worse at 2 degrees centigrade than 1.5. So half a degree may not sound much to most of us, but particularly if you live in Manchester, I mean, we'd like some more warmth, really. But actually, when you look at it in terms of ecosystem impacts, in terms of additional risks of feedbacks, and also lots of more people impacted by climate change seriously, between 2 and 1.5. So 1.5, you can definitely see good reasons for going there. But then when you look at the mitigation story, it's the usual sort of thing, loads and loads of negative emissions, anything to delay action. So the way I see it is we have to aim for 2 degrees centigrade with what I call real mitigation, which is actually reducing our emissions. And maybe that's to be complemented with some sort of planetary scale negative emissions, which if they work at scale, great. And I'm all for, let's fund a really good program of looking into these things, but let's not assume they work. Let's assume they don't work. But let's fund some good research into them. The IPCC claim that few trade-offs and strong synergies between 1.5 mitigation and economic growth. Does anyone actually believe that? You know, what we'd have to do for 1.5 somehow fits with a growing economy. I think really no one's really thought that through. That's just there to assuage the economic sensibilities of our political system. However we may wish, climate change is ultimately a rationing issue. We've got to ration out our very limited amount of carbon emissions. And we don't like the idea of rationing, but that's what it is. There's no neat way out of that. Ignoring the huge inequality in emissions again, the IPCC chooses to construct its policy advice to neatly fit with the current economic model. So let's go back to 2 degrees centigrade of framing. The first IPCC report came out before most of your parents met. Think about that. Quite a lot of you here, your parents hadn't met, and we had the first report from the IPCC which told us basically everything we needed to know to respond to climate change. So during all of your life, your parents and people of my generation have chosen to fail you. We had the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. Probably a few of you then weren't even born. Yet in 2018, emissions were 65%, almost 65%, so higher than in 1990. 2018, they looked like they've risen by about 2 to 3%, 2.7% is the best guess at the moment from the Global Carbon Project. So despite all this, we've actually seen emissions still going up. Just think about it. Emissions are still rising 28 to 29 years after the first IPCC report. Despite all the optimistic rhetoric and smiling, grinning policymakers, entrepreneurs and academics, we've had 28 years of abject failure on climate change. And I think it's worth just reminding how appallingly we've failed. It's not that we haven't brought the emissions down, we've just watched them go up. And in fact, since 2000, the rate at which they've gone up is even faster than during the 1990s. And why have we seen this? Well, there's a whole suite of reasons, but I think it is important to sort of capture a few of the things that have helped us avoid any action. Offsetting. Let's pay the poor people to diet for us. If you want to lose weight, you can't ask someone else to cut back on the chocolate. And it's the same with climate change. You can't ask someone else to do it for you. Yet we then sanction that at a government level with a clean development mechanism. As soon as you start to give these things an official sounding name, they sound like they actually mean something in the real world, which of course they don't, other than procrastination. So that was state-sanctioned offsetting. Then we had the emissions trading scheme, where let's say we have so many permits issued that the price of carbon remains virtually zero. Now that's changing, but it's been a long time since the EU ETS was actually there. So in the interim, it's been used as an excuse again for inaction. You can just look at the literature in the UK about that. Then we have this idea now of afforestation, plant a tree, grow an airport. That's the argument that's been made for the main airport in Stockholm in Sweden. We can expand the Arlanda airport because we're going to plant more trees in Sweden. And if all that fails, as it's going to, then we're relying on speculative negative emissions at huge planetary scale. Astronomical levels of negative emissions are assumed in most of the models. I'm not saying that they won't work, but we also don't know if they will. And there's certainly a lot of concern about whether they work at any planetary scale. And when that lot doesn't work, we're going to have a sticking plaster called geoengineering. So we're not going to try and solve the problem. We're going to put something over the top of it and mask it. Again, maybe there are some merits for that, perhaps for some sort of select ecosystems, if we can control it in some way. But the idea that this is what we're doing, and yet we have not tried yet to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. So we've had climate change. We've had a good understanding since 1990, if not before. And we haven't tried to reduce our emissions. We've tried all this lot, though. And it's easy to turn around, as you'll find lots of co-opted academics in the UK will do, and the NGOs, and say, well, look, the UK is doing really well. We've got, you know, we've got green growth here. We're at decoupling. Sweden says that, Denmark says that, and France says it. So the four sort of European climate progressive countries. And yet, when you actually look at it, there's no change in our emissions since, virtually no change in our emissions since 1990. The UK is a slight exception. It's come down at 0.4% per annum. Yee-haw. 0.4% from 1990. Once you factor in aviation and shipping, which most of the analysis conveniently ignore, I don't know who takes responsibility for those emissions, it must be God. No country takes responsibility for them. They're every country trying to grow them. And imports and exports. You take those into account, operating UK PLC and these other countries have seen no reduction since 1990. Norway is up 50%, Ireland's up 25%. I could get this wrong. I think it's either Belgium or the Netherlands, so I should really check. One of those is up by about 25%. So you just don't see much success, even in what are often seen to be climate progressive countries. So let's not pretend that we've succeeded. So once you've laid out really where we are now, as I would see it, and you may disagree with some of the numbers, but most of them just come from government stats, where do we go from here? Now, well, we've got the AR5 reports from the IPCC, and I'm going to summarise them in one sentence, which is obviously clearly very unfair. It's carbon budgets that matter, and I know that there'll be some people here, as I'm looking over there, that would slightly disagree with that view, but I think it's probably quite nuanced, but we can discuss that maybe later. It's not long-term targets. What we do by 2050 doesn't really matter if we just leave it out till 2040 before doing anything. So think of it this way, it's, you know, the temperature relates to the total amount of CO2 we dump in the atmosphere and the concentration in the CO2 in the atmosphere. So if we decide to expand Heathrow Airport, or just as we have done now, just celebrate the launch of a new oil platform, the Clair Ridge platform, 50,000 tonnes of CO2 a day from that oil platform, the life expectancy from BP is it'll put out another 250 million tonnes. That platform only went out in December, celebrated by Claire Perry, the Minister for Energy and Clean Growth, during the Katowice COP. The other day I was at another event at a court case trying to stop some more shale gas development in the northwest. Shale gas development, 75% is methane, 75% by weight of it is carbon, so when you burn it you get lots of CO2. So we've got Heathrow, shale gas, new oil platforms. So that's what this is. And then next generation have to do this, have to suck it out of the atmosphere in some way or find some very fast ways of mitigation. So it's the air end of the curve that matters. So every day we choose to fail now, we are passing again generationally the burden onto some of you here. So how big is the budget? And this is where we can have a lot of arguments as to how big the budget is, and I'm going to come back to that a little bit later, but I think it can be a bit of a technical distraction to some extent. So going from AR5, and we could argue we should use the stuff from the 1.5 report, but there are some reasons why I'm not doing that here. We've probably got about 700 billion tonnes of CO2 left. Now, it could be a bit higher than that, it could be a bit lower than that, and I'll touch on that in a minute. But something like that. That's the same sort of range that the IEA use, same starting values from the International Energy Agency or the recent Rockstrom paper. So it's not an uncommon sort of starting point. And we dump about 43 billion tonnes of CO2 in the atmosphere each year at the moment. That's about 16 years of current emissions. Something like that. So if you want to quantify this in relation to the Paris Agreement and what we need to do, so before Paris, we were heading this direction, RCP 8.5, 4 to 6 degrees C of warming, which just worth bearing in mind, the difference between now and ice age is something like 5 degrees, obviously in the other direction, but it's that sort of change that you're seeing in really the blink of an eye. And the Paris pledges add up to something like 3 to 4 degrees centigrade. Remember, the pledges themselves, the official period, is only 2020 to 2030, and they're not necessarily all reduction rates. They can be peak rates, they can be sort of carbon intensity of the economy. There can be all sorts of other ways that they're included. So that's what the rule book at Katowice is supposed to try to clarify. But they're a bit mess, really. But if you try and make some assumptions around them, you look at something like this. And I would argue we should be, from 2019, somewhere around 700 billion tonnes, something like that. Basically, zero emissions from energy, this is. I'm not focusing on the other non-CO2 emissions, which need to come down. I can talk about those if you want to. But yeah, the non-CO2 need to come down, but we go always have some methane and some N2O emissions if we carry on with agriculture, eating food. So we can't get those to zero. We can probably get them down a long way. I would probably estimate somewhere at 4 to 6 billion tonnes equivalent for the agricultural emissions of feeding 9 billion people. But that's a separate issue to hear. So for energy, zero by 2050. We also signed up on the basis of equity, even though we didn't mean it, which means that the wealthy countries have to do something a little bit ahead of the poorer countries. And that whole sort of common but differentiated responsibility goes right back to really Kyoto and from there. So we repeatedly say that, though it has been weakened in Katowice yet again. So I would argue this is quite a different picture to the euphoria we saw in Paris. And why is that the case? And also, I think quite a lot of the optimism we often see about what we're going to do about climate change. And I think it's because the policymakers have received a very different story. And also, I think they have wanted to receive a very different story. They don't like this one, nor do most of us who work in the area. And their advice has been dominated by a particular group of modellers, who some of you will be familiar with, maybe some of you engage in this, the integrated assessment modelling community. And they bring together simplified climate models with particular types of economic models, normally something along a general equilibrium, near classical growth model, something along those sorts of lines. And then they sort of make some assessment of how you have something like a cost-optimized or a cost-effective solution to climate change. They have much larger carbon budgets that sort of emerge from their analysis, with obviously much, much less challenging mitigation. So if you took the scenarios submitted to the IPCC for I think this was for a 66% chance of 2 degrees centigrade, about 100 or so of them, then they are the median value of something like 600 billion tonnes of CO2. This is from 2017 when you work it out. And you have to compare that with, as I'll show now, 800 from the science in 2017, or sort of heading towards 700 now. So this is obviously a couple of years ago. But the economic modellers are telling us that we've got nearer 1600. So there's a very big difference between the two. And I think it's quite hard for a lot of people to really understand, well, how can there be such large differences? And those large differences pretty much, this is probably my second favourite climate change film, Dr. Strangelove. It's a really good example of how men love technology, and they're going to use it, not all men, but it's generally men, and they think it's going to solve all these climate change problems, or whatever problems he was dealing with, which were not climate change at the time. But I think it captures something about the essence and the approach we have taken to responding to climate change so far. The other film, I think, is Merchants of Doubt, which is a fantastic film, Noam Oreskes and Eric Conway's movie. The book is excellent, but the film has a lot of different material to the book. Have any of you seen Merchants of Doubt? And it had virtually no circulation. I wonder why, no idea. So what we've done is we're pulling rabbits from hats. We've conjured up, and I think that's still the right term to use at the planetary scale, because we don't have these things. They're still quite conceptual, really, at best, I think. And we've conjured up this whole concept of negative emission technologies. Certainly at scale, we've conjured them up to suck hundreds of billions of tons from the atmosphere at some point in the future. And they say, we haven't conjured them up. Well, we've conjured them up, but you're going to have to invent them and get them to work. And we're passing that on to you again. We'll be living in Tuscany, retired by then. Well, perhaps not Tuscany, it might be a bit too hot, but anyway, perhaps Stockholm. So the emissions go out like this. This is taken again from the sort of median values going out in the 2 degrees scenarios for IPCC. But what's worrying is that they go way after the end of the century. So because we can't be bothered to do anything here, you know, your children, some of your children, and probably some of your grandchildren will have to be sucking our CO2 out in the atmosphere in the future. So it is worth just thinking about what we're doing here. We're relying on technologies in the future to solve these issues for us. And we're also relying on hopefully not having some additional feedbacks. So Paris, some academics and politicians, rather than focus on urgent and deep mitigation today, rather than question the system, because that has massive political economic repercussions, we'd rather rely on, at the moment, non-existent technologies to suck hundreds of billions, sometimes up to a trillion tons of CO2 from the air out into the future. If you look at most of the scenarios, they see ongoing use of fossil fuels. There's a great surprise. And basically no major social change required. So business as usual. Davos carries on. So I think that's really the framing that we've had, that implicitly, sometimes explicitly informs our thinking around climate change. So if we take away the negative emissions and then start to say, well, what would that look like for the UK? And we've done this now for the UK, we've done it for Sweden, we've done it for quite a few parts of the world, including the EU. We've been feeding into the EU carbon budget debate at the moment. And we've even taken them down to city levels. So we're getting carbon budgets for cities with the huge uncertainties around them. But I think from a policy perspective, it gives us a really clear picture. So for 2 degrees centigrade of warming, we have a global pie. In Manchester, we like pies, so that's why you've got pies here. And if you're Miles Allen, the pie's a bit bigger. And if you're Jason Lowe in the Met Office, the pie's a bit smaller. But the pie is broadly the pie, and we can all argue about quite how big it is, but people take a slightly different view, and you can have these arguments about climate sensitivity and what temperature you start from, and a whole host of other things you can embed in there. But basically the Met Office and Miles, if you like, take the two ends of that. But we'll just stick with the AR5 for now until we can get something better. So we've got about 700 billion tonnes, and then we have the simple task of splitting amongst the world's nations. And that's obviously, we're all going to be quite clear and honest about that, aren't we? Just ask for just the right slice size for us. Of course, that's not what happens. There are some interesting, I gather, there's some interesting sort of things in philosophy that help us understand this. If you've got the Chinese negotiate for the European Union for Nigeria for the US, then actually your negotiations from that, I understand, will give you a much fairer allocation. It's only when you get people to negotiate for themselves, they always want a bigger slice. So there are ways we could rethink how to do the negotiations if we were serious about climate change. So we asked the question, what's a fair slice for the EU? And that pie could be quite a lot bigger or quite a lot smaller, because you can divide it out on the basis of historical responsibility, population, grandfathered emissions, all sorts of things you can divide it out from. So we've got a range there, just showing one slice for now. And then we've asked the question, of that, how much would the UK get? And from the UK, we're using, we can go into this later if you want, we use grandfathering. We think grandfathering, once you've gone away from the non-OECD countries, we think grandfathering with an equity coefficient is probably the fairest way of allocating out a very tight budget. Grandfathering means you just look at your recent sort of sets of emissions over the last 5 years or so and take your proportion of the total over that period and use that to allocate out the budget. So there are some reasons why we think that's much fairer. Population's not very fair. We can have arguments about historical responsibility. I think there's some big issues there, but we can talk about that if we need to. But this is within the EU we're doing this now. So grandfathering is what we use. We still get a big range. Includes aviation and shipping. Excludes imports and exports. So we're not doing consumption-based, even though I think obviously that's a very important set of analysis that needs to be done alongside this, but with much greater uncertainty. And so you end up with a big range. You know, basically 3 to 4 gigatons for the UK, and that probably means nothing to many of you, but if you look at what our emissions are in the UK, if you include aviation and shipping, it's about 7 to 9 years of current emissions. So Miles would say that's what you've got for 1.5 degrees C. Jason would say, well, that's way over 2 degrees C. But you know, so it gives you a flavour of what we would need to be doing. And if you play that out in terms of mitigation rates, it's something well over 10% per annum reduction rates, well over. I mean, I really should put the numbers a bit higher than this. If you play it out, it comes out nearer 15 to 20%, but we sort of always err on the side of being too optimistic, perhaps, even when we're doing this analysis. So something like that. That's a sort of total reduction of something like 75% reduction by about 2025, which is really just tomorrow when you think about it. And fully decarbonised energy system, energy note here, for the UK, but mostly or pretty much all OECD countries would be somewhere between 2035 and 2040 to be zero carbon energy, not low, zero carbon energy. And the non-OECD countries are about 15 years later than that. And within those bounds, some would be later than others. So Germany would be a bit earlier than Greece, and Greece would be a bit later and that sort of thing. And the same within non-OECD. Some countries would have a lot longer, and other countries like China would have to be a lot sooner in the emissions. And we can talk about that later if someone wants to ask me about the numbers behind it all. But that gives you a flavour of what we'd have to try and do. And whichever way you could play with the budgets, it doesn't really move away from the fact we're talking about an order of magnitude rate of mitigation different to anyone else's analysis, pretty much. So it's a complete different agenda to the normal one that we get to hear. So a reasonable question to ask then is, are these rates viable? And I was almost bordering on no until quite recently, about a year and a half ago probably. My colleague Alice Larkin, previously Bose, she thinks it is impossible. Glenn Peters, one of my colleagues and someone I work with from time to time in Norway, thinks it's impossible. I'm aware that one or two people here who remain nameless think it's impossible as well. And I'm bordering on that, but I'm not quite sure yet. But I think I could envisage how you could deliver on it. And I'm going to try and touch on that in a minute. And it comes back to this issue of equity. The IPCC plus Paris equals equity? That's my sort of question. That goes back to my first opening thought experiment about the big reductions that we could have from a small percentage of the population. CO2 is highly skewed to a small group of the population at a global level. So this is global income deciles. So this is, have you all seen this before? No, okay. Oh, it's a really useful slide. Never makes it into the IPCC reports, but anyway. That's probably because it is useful. What you have here are income deciles, poorest, the richest, and these are the emissions. And what you see is the poorest 50% are responsible for about 10% of global emissions. This is taken from the work by Lucas Chancellor and Thomas Piketty in 2015. And the infographic was done by Oxfam later on, but it's based on their data. And it's a really interesting methodology. I'd definitely recommend reading the report. It's a really interesting method that they've used to try to take total global emissions and then attribute them to the activities of individuals within the world. So it doesn't take a national approach at all. So if you go to the top 10% here, so most emissions relate to the top group here, as you can imagine. 50% of global emissions come from 10% of the global population. 50% from 10% of the population. And we know who they are. Yeah, academics, climate change audiences, policymakers, business people. We know that 10% are. And we see them when we shave or put our makeup on. About 70% of global emissions come from 20% of the population. So why is it when we have policies, the policies are generally aimed at the whole population and basically squeezing the emissions out of those people that hardly emit. Now, this is a completely different agenda now. It says you've got to tailor your policies to those that emit. What a radical idea. But we don't do that at the moment. We try and squeeze them out of the people that barely emit. And people like me love the idea of a carbon price because professors can just afford it. I can just pay the extra on the price of a flight or a fancy car. A carbon price means nothing to me. But if you live in the fuel poverty homes around Manchester, you can't even afford energy today, let alone a carbon price on top of the energy. So massive equity implications for some of these things. And I would argue when you start to see it like this, that you end up, I would suggest from, I'm not saying what the policies would look like, but if we're serious about anything like a 2 degree C framing, then there's a three-phase strategy you have to have. And I can't see a way out of this, and it's partly because of the time frame issues, coming back to the curves earlier. In the immediate term, you have to have profound changes in the behaviours and the energy-related behaviours and practices of high energy users. That includes consumption, because above a certain threshold, our emissions come out of our consumption rather than out of our energy use. So once you get really above professor levels, then you start to see people's consumption habits are where the energy and the emissions are locked in. That's what's interesting in the methodology that Chancellor Piketty used. So I'm not saying it's going to happen voluntarily. You'd have to have regulations to drive this in some way, but it would be helpful if some people who are in that category started to demonstrate they could do it.
That was part one of a 50-minute lecture at the Oxford Climate Society. Kevin Anderson is chair of Energy and Climate Change at the School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester, UK. He spoke on January 25, 2019. Kevin also engages widely across all tiers of governments in Europe. His research is published in Science, Nature, and Nature Geosciences. Come back for part two when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.